Well, good morning, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another terrific episode of Meet the Expert. I am very excited. I'm Elliot Callahan. I'm president of Prosperity Financial Group here in San Ramon, California. If you want to pop me an email, it's Elliot, E-L-L-I-O-T, at prosperityfinancialgroup.com. If you want to call me, it's 925-314-8503. We'd love to talk to you about any questions you might have about the world of portfolios and investments. And now we're going to talk about economics. So today, because the world is kind of changing and it's changing very quickly, in some way, there's some parallels to the 1930s, the 1920s, ugly times out there, potential for this whole dark cloud to go away and potential for this dark cloud to hang around. We'll see what happens. So we're talking with Andrew Updike. Andrew is with First Trust. He's a senior economist. He's got an MBA from Northwestern. We won't hold the city of Chicago against him. That's actually not Chicago. That's outside of Chicago, but he's coming to us from Chicago today. Beautiful background. If you get to read what's behind his wall, it's got some interesting people on there and some features. So Andrew, welcome.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Well, great. And so let's talk about economics. Let's talk about the markets. Let's talk about China, Russia, people's portfolio, behavioral finance. There's fear everywhere around us right now. So first, let's talk about the impact that global geopolitics is having on the U.S. markets, and it's having on global investments as well. And let's start with Europe and Ukraine and Russia. And let's go over, when we're done with that, let's go over to China and a potential for Taiwan and the little episode that happened yesterday with Australia. So let me turn it over to you. Go ahead, Andrew.
Yeah, well, let's start off by saying, you know, times are never boring. There's always going to be something the market's worried about, the economy is worried about. And as we kind of moving on from COVID, here we have Russia and Ukraine. At the same time, we have rates. I would argue those are the two big R's this year, is the Russia issues, what's going to happen with interest rates. Here's what I'll say. I focus my time on economics. I'm not a geopolitical expert. I don't know what Putin's going to do over the next 2 days, 3 days, week, month. I don't know if anybody really knows what he's going to do other than Putin himself. But here's the thing. We have to watch these international situations, whether it's Russia, Ukraine, whether it's, I do believe that if China invaded Taiwan, that would have more of a substantive impact globally. But I personally do not think that China's going to invade Taiwan. When I watch what's going on with the Russia, Ukraine, it's going to have impacts on energy prices. It's going to have impacts on Europe, I think, more so than the United States. They're larger trade partners. They have a greater dependence. I have a feeling that as we move further into this year, as we get to the end of 2022 and we look back on the year, the determining factor on did the economy grow or not grow, are the markets up or down, is probably not going to come down to Russia. It's going to be more that other R. It's going to be interest rates. It's going to be what happened with inflation. We're going to have conflicts. This is not a new thing to 2022, but I think it's a temporary factor.
Okay, so let's discount completely that China's kind of having some fun out in the Far East and shot a laser beam yesterday at an Australian warship. We'll call that a temporary error in the economy here, right? And Russia's probably going to invade Ukraine, and that won't last very long. Most probably so, correct?
Base case.
With no crystal ball, let's talk about people's money. Because what it's doing there, Andrew, is that it's creating fear.
Yeah.
And so behavioral finance is all about fear or euphoria. It almost works in extremes. You know, on the left side, we'll forget liberal and conservative for a moment. On the left side, we have euphoria. On the right side, we have absolute fear. When people are in fear, they're buying treasuries and they're going to CDs at banks. When people are euphoric, our world, the world of financial advisory and investing world, is booming. And right now, I'm getting phone calls every single day and worried that, how long is this going to last?
Yeah. And you know, again, it's not a new thing. I will say, start off, first of all, emotions historically have not been a great guide to investment decision making. And you know, we start off this year. We just had the S&P go into correction. It's down 10% for the year. Earlier, we had the NASDAQ go down. So I'm looking back at history. How frequently does something like this happen? It feels like it's been quick. It feels like it's a sharp start to the year. And you know, through the first 2 months of the year, it is. But you got to remember, volatility is pretty normal I would argue the last 18 months, as we moved on from COVID, as we got kind of May of 2020 through the end of last year, where we didn't really see a drawdown, that was the unusual period. You look back at something like the NASDAQ, okay? Let's go back in history. The NASDAQ came into existence in February of 1971. It's been around for 51 years. How many times have we seen a pullback of 10% or more? Well, over that 51-year time period, we've seen it 66 times. On average, we see it more than once per year. And it can be gut-wrenching. It's gut-wrenching to see this money that you spent your time, your tears, your effort, your blood, your sweat, in order to build up over a career, this money you're putting away for retirement, and to see those pullbacks take place. It's uncomfortable. But here's the thing. I don't know about you. I can't time the market. I didn't call any of those 66 corrections. But if you look at it over time, the NASDAQ started in 1971 at an index value of 100. Today, it's 13,500. It's up 135-fold over that time period. Uncertainty, volatility are part and parcel of the game. If the uncertainty wasn't there, the opportunity wouldn't be there. So for me, one of the best things you can do in an environment like this is take a step back, take a breath, focus on the fundamentals, and say, do I believe these companies? Do I believe that the U.S. economy is going to continue to grow over time? And if so, are you going to give up something that you think is going to grow, that's going to add value into the future for an event that you think is temporary? I would argue those short-term reactions to things we can't control, emotional reactions, they don't benefit us. We need to gain perspective. We need to have a framework to evaluate where we got, where we are, and to see if the fundamentals have really shifted. And I would argue right now, the fundamentals suggest economic growth is going to occur in 2022. And personally, I expect that the market's going to continue to move higher as well. Not in a straight line. It never is. But I believe that that over time, the math's going to win out.
So, Andrew, we're here in Northern California. And we're talking to Andrew Updike, who's a senior economist with First Trust out of Chicago. In Northern California, the conversation is technology, 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 technology. That's just what it is. And so our moderate and our growth portfolios are heavily weighted towards technology, little less than they were last year, but they're still heavily weighted. And of course, that's all part of the growth sector, which has been beaten up starting in about last October. And so our clients really in those sectors have seen more or less a consistent, steady flow down, even though we've thinned out those margins. So do I bet against technology and throw it out with the baby in the bathwater, or is technology still a wonderful place to be?
So here's what I would say on the technology sector. I still believe that some of the technology companies that we have in the United States today are some of the greatest companies that have ever existed in the history of this world. Okay, I think that we have some unbelievable products, services that are going to continue to grow into the future. One of the key questions, though, is you take technology as a whole, and technology is very focused on growth. It's about where are things going to be 5 years from now, 10 years from now. In this environment where inflation is high and the expectation is rising rates, we have to think about what is the value of a dollar created today versus a dollar created 5 years from now, 10 years from now. And I think what the market is doing is looking at two things. They're looking at one and saying that dollar you're going to create 5 years, 10 years down the road from us, if inflation is higher than we expected and potentially even moving higher, those future cash flows are worth less to us today. It's bringing down the value, the price people are willing to pay for that future growth. The other thing is that we saw a lot of new activity take place over the last 18 months. We've seen a massive IPO activity, a lot of new companies come to market. And these companies that have come to market, more so than the big names that we're so familiar with, are unprofitable technology right now. It's kind of tilted some of the technology towards these groups that have those future cash flows that I think are really being hit. So my perspective is I'm not abandoning technology, but I do want to be critical about where I'm allocating within that, what type of characteristics I'm looking for in companies. I want companies that have earnings today. I want companies with quality balance sheets. As the U.S. is expanding and we are in recovery mode, I want companies that have the capacity to be investing into this, because the world is becoming more technological, not less. We're going to need more cybersecurity. We're going to need more 5G. As we saw in 2020, the reason we survived COVID during 2020 is because we were able to move from the outside inside and the inside online in a way that, think 20 years ago, Go back 22 years ago to the year 2000. Y2K. And think about how far we've come in 22 years. Our ability to operate when we were pushed inside is completely different. And a lot of it's due to these tech companies that have led the way, that have grown into behemoths. So summarizing that, I still like technology, but I want to be very intentional about where those allocations are, because they're going to, more so than an industrial or a material company, their cash flows into the future hold a greater weight in their value today.
So speaking of sectors, because technology is a sector, Andrew, another sector we should talk about is energy. Mm-hmm. Energy, you know, wasn't very long ago that America had all types of oil independence and gas independence. Now we don't anymore. Now we're back to the Middle East companies dominating, and we're just the afterthought in some way. Not completely true, but some way we're the afterthought. Mm-hmm. That, you know, master limited partnerships made money early on, and then they were the world's worst investment. And oil companies in the last 5 years were just horrible under the Trump administration. And of course, but oil was $0 to $30 a barrel. Now it's $90. So, do we want to be in that sector, or is that sector on its way back to $30?
Yeah, so I think the big question to me is what's going to bring capacity back online, and what's going to impact the demand side of the equation? And what we've seen, there's the biggest shift that I think we've seen in the last 2-3 years on the energy side is with the major domestic U.S. energy producers. They've done two things. One is that they've committed to higher ESG standards. They want to reduce emissions, and that has prevented them. It's basically tied their hands from bringing significant new capacity online, right? So as the Middle East, as OPEC was pulling back, if these oil majors wanted to try to fill that gap, and don't get me wrong, they have the capacity. They have the wells, whether that's in the Permian or the Eagle Ford, the Utica Shale, they have the capacity to bring new production online. But in order to do that, they would have to violate the ESG mandates they committed to over the last 2-3 years. The other side of the equation is at the same time they were making those ESG mandates, they were also committing to returns to capital. Go back to 2012, 13, 14, 15, 16. It was an all-out expansion phase. They were spending more money than they were taking in. They were kind of money losers at that point because they wanted to be increasing capacity. They wanted to be buying new land. It was this race to bring the U.S. up to the top to global leadership on oil. And their investor said, look, you keep spending more than you take in. We need to start seeing the fruits of this labor. We need to start seeing the fruits of this investment. And so these companies have kind of started to pull back. They've reined in new capital expenditure spending, and they're doing more return of capital. If you tie these two pieces together, a commitment to return capital and a commitment to ESG standards, it's put us in this position where the oil majors in the United States, some private companies are bringing capacity back online, but the groups that can move the needle in the United States aren't really moving. And so unlike 14, 15, 16, where the Saudis said, look, we're going to dump oil on the markets, because what they were trying to do was push out some of these big oil producers in the United States who were starting to take market share, I think OPEC's looking at this and saying, the U.S. is not ramping up production. We, as long as we keep oil at a moderate output, we can maintain prices at $80, $90 per barrel for now. And with a Russia-Ukraine conflict and the impact that is going to in particular have on Europe, we could see oil prices hit $100. Do I think it's going to sustain there for the next 5 years? No, but I do think temporarily these energy companies have an opportunity to take in major revenues by keeping these levels high. And I think we're going to see that return of capital to consumers. So personally, I do like the energy space at this time. I don't think we're going to see a push back to $30, $40 in oil anytime in the next 12, 18 months.
Okay. So we keep talking about sectors. Let's go to where people look for safe havens, and that's bonds. So I'm sure everybody knows that we're going to get some interest rate increases from the Federal Reserve, Andrew. That's just coming. Yeah. Whether it's going to be 3 this year, 5 or 7, that's a guess. But we're going to get it. And for those of you who didn't know that, that's the organization that is in charge of keeping inflation down, the Federal Reserve System, private entity out of Delaware. And they work with us. They work with our government for about 100 years now in controlling inflation. And they don't want to have happen today what happened in the 1970s, which was runaway inflation. You know, interest rates back at 20 and 21%. Mortgage rates have been kept down for some time. It's been a seller's market, unbelievable. normal I know is about 5%. And suddenly if I said 5%, people go through the roof thinking, oh my God, I'm going to get a 5% mortgage. I'll never be able to afford that. And that's pretty normal over the scheme of things outside the 1970s. I think that was my parents' mortgage in the 1950s, 5%. But we're going to get interest rate increases. Money is going to become more expensive to do business with and fungible. So let's talk about that. So at the same time, what that's doing is driving down the value of bonds and bond funds that are not in anything but high yield. And right now, high yield is beaten up. So or in floating rate, which is a hard play to know when to get in, when to get out. So one of these conservative investors, we talked earlier about growth and moderate growth investors, do is don't throw out the baby in the bathwater. Look for quality, is I think what you said, right?
Yeah.
What do these people who are conservative do?
Yeah, it's a great question. And let's be real. If you think about fixed income, you think about the bonds, think about these individuals, again, who have saved this money through retirement. Now they're going into retirement. They want predictable cash flows. They want safety. They don't want to see these wide swings in the value of their savings, of their investment. Now, over the last 4 or 5 years, right, have they been properly compensated for the risk of lending? I would argue the answer is clearly no. And if you were thinking people who were retiring, you know, over the last few years and who were planning for this in the 80s and the 90s and the early 2000s, when they started planning for retirement, could they have imagined a world where the 10-year treasury rate was below 1%? I think it was unimaginable 20, 30, 40 years ago. So it's a difficult space to be in. You're coming in to 2022. You're coming off of a period where interest rates were near historic lows. At the same time, inflation is at multi-decade highs. So I think on the fixed income side, on the bond side, it's going to be a difficult time this year. You have to determine what is your priority. Are you looking to get yield? Are you looking at this to bring the income? And you're going to accept the fact you could have more volatility along with that. Are you looking for something that has high diversification? So if the equity markets are down, then you've got more protection on the bond side. Or are you looking to protect against these rising rates? Right. The term that we use in fixed income in the bond world is we look at a number called duration. Okay. So duration, essentially, it means that for every 1% rise in rates, this is how much you would expect the price of a bond to decline. So a 10-year treasury has a duration of 8. That means that if rates rise by 1%, today they're at 2%, let's say they go from 2% to 3%, the price of a bond that you hold, a 10-year treasury that you hold, would fall by 8%. Now, you'd get a 2% yield right now, but it means that you would lose 6% of the value. So this duration, this risk you have in a rising rate environment, how much of that are you trying to hedge out? How much of that are you trying to take away from? But trying to get all three of these, trying to get diversification, trying to get yield, and trying to get protection from rising rates, there's nothing really that's checking all three boxes this year. So you have to be very intentional. You have to you know, some of it may be making some sacrifices, but we have to be intelligent about where we're allocating and what matters the most to us right now. Now, no, this is a temporary thing. You still want to have this exposure. You want to have some exposure to equities. You want to have some exposure to fixed income. They play different roles within the portfolio. And in some cases, right, if you need yield, some people are moving from fixed income from bonds to equities that act a little bit more like bonds. If you want to get that yield on the fixed income side, sometimes you're moving to fixed income that acts a little bit more like an equity. So unlike that the period that we've had, basically since 1980, rates have been in a pretty steady downward trend. That trend is starting to turn, and it's not just 2022. I think 2023, I think for the foreseeable future, the way we approach fixed income is going to have to shift. And I think our expectations on the returns we can get from it, the diversification is going to play in our portfolios. We're going to have to reset some expectations there as well.
Okay. So I want to talk about changing subjects completely with Andrew Updike, who's the senior economist with First Trust. I'm Elliot Callan. If you need to reach us, I'm at Elliot, E-L-L-I-O-T, at prosperityfinancialgroup.com. And we are a large San Ramon, California-based financial advisory RIA firm, and we are planned fiduciaries. And so I want to talk to you about Bitcoin and coinage and clients asking. They're not quite asking like they used to when Bitcoin was $69,000 a coin, and now it's a third less than that. But they're still wanting to know about this, the world of electronic coinage and a world of, you know, where are we going with this? So tell me about that. Educate our clients that Is that something they should be investing in? Is that something they should be looking at doing business in? Or is that just the Wild West of the gold rush?
Yeah, you know, I'd say it's still early days. And let me separate out Bitcoin from blockchain, right? Blockchain is the underlying technology that's behind Bitcoin and Ethereum and all these different cryptocurrencies. The blockchain is, going to be a powerful tool for tracking assets, for tracking ownership of securities, ownership of whatever it may be. But I have some concerns with some of the cryptocurrencies. And here's my concern. At the end of the day, you still have to pay your taxes in dollars, right? And so at the end of the day, the dollar remains king. And in order to get broad scale acceptance of cryptocurrencies, you're going to have to get passage by the IRS. You're going to have to get passage by Congress. You're going to have to get approval in Washington. Now, think back to what we've seen over the last 18 months. If we moved, let's say we moved to the U.S. and the U.S. moved to a Bitcoin currency and away from the dollar, which is the ideal situation, which would boost the value of Bitcoins. What could the U.S. government have done over the last 18 months in response to the crisis? Could they have spent $5 trillion in new funds? And the answer is no, because they couldn't have created $5 trillion worth of Bitcoin. Now, some people say this is exactly why we need Bitcoin. We need to control that spending. We need to make sure that they have to be responsible for the actions they do. And I, honestly, if it was up to me, I wouldn't hate a Bitcoin standard. I wouldn't hate something that ties the government from spending more than it takes in. But realistically, I don't know about you. I don't know anybody who's successfully gone to Washington and convinced the people on Capitol Hill to give up power. I don't know anybody who's convinced the Federal Reserve to give up power. I don't know anybody who convinces the Treasury to give up power. So I am a little more hesitant on the cryptocurrencies. I like blockchain, and I like some of the technology that's going to be surrounding it. Some of the payment processing, the fact that we're going to need things like semiconductors, whether that's for Bitcoin or just, again, for this continued move towards a more technological world. Could I be completely wrong on this? Entirely possible. Right? And could Bitcoin go up before it goes down? Absolutely. I don't have a crystal ball. I can't tell you where it's going to be tonight, tomorrow, next week, next month, next year. But I'm a numbers guy. I'm a fundamentals guy. And the things that I think it needs to check off in order to really be a long-term tool in the United States, I think it's going to have a very, very difficult time getting across those goal lines.
Well, why hasn't the U.S. come up with a U.S. coin? Well, I mean, I'm wondering here, why the Treasury? Are these just people too old to think in those terms?
Yeah, it's a great question. Think about this. Why do we need a Bitcoin in the United States? And people say, oh, well, cryptocurrencies, it would ease the speed of transactions, and it's a reliable thing that people will accept whether I'm here or whether I'm in Sudan or whether I'm in Argentina or whether I'm in Germany. It turns out that we largely have something like that today, and it's called the U.S. dollar. Other countries trust the value of the U.S. dollar. They will accept U.S. dollars for essentially any transaction. The speed at which we can process transactions right now is unbelievably fast. So the Federal Reserve, and it was Randall Quarles, he used to be the head of regulation. He's since left the Fed. They're putting somebody new in charge of that, and it may be Lael Brainard, who's already a Fed governor. He put out a paper on this about a year ago. Does the U.S. need its own digital currency? And when he ran down the list of what a digital currency would accomplish, essentially what he found is we're already doing it with U.S. dollars. And the digital system we have to transfer money between banks, to transfer between the central bank and the banks, to transfer money across boundaries is largely already being accomplished by the tools we have in place. It doesn't do the same level of tracking, and it doesn't have that, with blockchain, the idea is it's a decentralized platform. But there's some arguments you can make in there. There's some areas where decentralization is a risk, maybe not so much a benefit. So I don't think that the banks, and remember, the Federal Reserve, who's the interest rate setting body, is the regulator of the banks. I do not think they feel the need for a digital currency at this time. Because again, the U.S. dollar is the world's reserve currency. I do not see that changing here in the foreseeable future. And the technology we have behind our banking system allows us to already move at an incredibly quick pace.
So let's go back as we begin to wrap this up, Andrew. Let's just go back to behavioral finance, and that is the fear factor, fear and euphoria again, you know, on both sides of that spectrum, fear and euphoria. And clients are losing money right now. They're down, you know, 5, 10, 15%, 20%. If you invested in financial technology, just the sector, you could be off by 40 or 50% on some of these companies. Yep. So what's good advice from an economist to these people that have a long-term vision but are scared to death on the month over month?
Yeah, my best advice is stick to the fundamentals. We look at things like earnings per share. If the markets are down, right? S&P is down about 10%. Earnings growth expectations have risen over this time period. And while emotion can work in the short term, right? I think it was Ben Graham, who was the guy that Warren Buffett always pointed to as one of the godfathers of investing. He said, the markets in the short term, they're a voting machine. In the long term, they're a weighing machine. Okay. You got to remember that emotions can have significant impacts in the short term. But if you, and listen, if you can time the market, quite frankly, you shouldn't be listening to this conversation. You should be sitting on a beach in the Bahamas sipping a Mai Tai. I can't time the markets. And so what I focus on is time in the markets. You are rewarded for time in the markets. And right now, because these downturns, these pullbacks happen on a fairly regular basis. Again, I'm going to say Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett said the line, he's greedy when others are fearful and fearful when others are greedy. I don't see too many people when we have a Black Friday sale, I don't see too many people going to the store and saying, oh my gosh, that vacuum cleaner cost 20% more last week. I don't want to touch it. But for some reason, when stocks go on sale, when we see a pullback, everybody just assumes it's going to go further. The volatility is normal. And if you take advantage of the volatility, if the fundamentals haven't changed, you will be rewarded over time. So get a plan in place, a plan that helps you bring the emotions out of it, a plan that says, look, because we don't know where things are going to be next week, next month, next year, here are the rules that we're going to live by. Here are the things that we're going to focus on that'll help us determine whether the markets should continue to move higher or lower over time. And then enjoy that time in the markets because you will be rewarded for it.
Great. So this has been a great conversation. Andrew, did I miss anything that you think?
I think that covers it.
Great. So we've been talking with Andrew Updike. I'm Elliot Callan, president of Prosperity Financial Group in San Ramon. We've been talking with Andrew Updike, who's a senior economist with First Trust out of Chicago. This has been a great conversation. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
And we look forward to seeing everybody on the next episode of Meet the Expert. Have a great day.